Hi there, my name's Oisin Nuddy and welcome to Audio Talks presented to you by Harman. Now, this is the podcast where music, technology and culture collide. And on New Year's Day, we are looking into the future with somebody who is fighting to make sure it is as good as it can possibly be. Now, from Manchester to the Bristol scene, from working with Massive Attack to Bjork to exploring spatial audio, our very special guest, Andrew Melchior, has spent his career at the edges of change. In this episode, we're going to talk about what happens when the ground keeps shifting beneath music and culture, when machines can imitate creativity, when shared rituals begin to fray and attention becomes our rarest and most precious resource. We're going to explore why music still matters, the risks and possibilities of synthetic media, and what it means to build tools for the future without losing our humanity. So this is going to be a conversation about where we've been and where we might still choose to go. Andrew Melchior, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. Very good intro. And it's a great pleasure to be here at the end of 2025, looking forward to the next year with you.
Absolutely. Well, we're billing this as the new year in brackets, our evolution. So it could be a revolution, it could be an evolution, and it's really up to the listeners to decide. So listen, let's just dive right into it. You have such a fascinating backstory. I was catching up on a bit of it before we hit the record button there. And you've lived in some very interesting places. You're joining us from Poland right now. Could you take us through a bit of your backstory, your journey from Manchester to Bristol, to working as Massive Attack CTO, to working with Bjork? There's so much interesting stuff in there, in the timeline. Talk to us a bit about where you've been and what are the threads that have held together this fascinating career and life?
Well, that's very kind of you to say so. It's interesting because the thread is just music. So the reason you and I know each other, the reason we're here and I'm doing this is because of my lifelong relationship to music. So I was born in West Germany in 1972, a long, long time ago now. I had a very great fortune of having a grandfather who was a classically trained pianist and who was also a medical doctor. And when I was a kid, he took a pair of headphones. I think they were Prince, P-R-I-N-S-I-N-Z headphones, stuck them on my head when I was, I must have been about 4 or 5 years old. And he played me Beethoven's Ninth Symphony on a Deutsche Grammophon label. And it was Raphael Kubelik, the conductor, Berlin Philharmonic. And it came in this beautiful box vinyl set. And it had a booklet, and in the booklet was Schiller's Ode to Joy, which is obviously Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and it had English and German translation either side. And I was a precocious little bilingual kid. My father's German, mother's English, and he stuck this thing on my head and went, listen to this. And as I listened, he said, he sort of moved the headphones slightly to one side, and as things were coming in, he was going, that is a cello, this is a violin, this is French horns, this is a trumpet, this is, and I was like, pfft. And I vividly remember this because it was Sunday afternoon at my grandparents and we'd had like lunch or something, even though I was really little. And as I was talking, I was looking at these words and I only just sort of fused them because I was a sprog, right? But that was the thing that started everything. So Erich Melchior, my granddad in Germany, who's been gone a long time now, lit the fire with that. And from that point on, I don't know, it all just sort of cascaded. So I was in West Germany and then my parents divorced, unfortunately, in the late 70s and I moved to the UK. And lived a bit of a culture shock because West Germany versus North Manchester, which is where I landed, Eaton Park with like Coronation Street terraces and cobble streets and stuff. But the music carried on. And, my mother was very fastidious. She was also a piano player, but she was into music as well. Had a great record collection I used to rifle through. I started playing these. One Christmas, she got this little Bontempi organ, these little air-powered organs. And on the left-hand side are like chord keys, you know, like C, D, E, F, G, A, B. And on the right-hand side, the keyboard, but all numbers. So like 1 + 2 + 3 + 4. She bought me this Beatles songbook and it was bright yellow and it was designed for this organ, right? And what could happen is, I remember Penny Lane was the first one I tried and you could basically play the Beatles by numbers, right? So I think I was like 7 when she got that. So I started learning to play keyboards very early on by paint by numbers version of Bontempi with the Beatles. I did that so much, she got me a bigger one the following year, these air-powered Bontempi things. And I did that so much, she went, if I buy you a piano, will you have lessons? And I went, yeah. Not knowing what that meant, unfortunately. I went, yeah, that sounds good. But unfortunately, the torture and the agony later on was like, oh, so possibly a bad idea. But she got me this secondhand Kemble piano and stuck it in the kitchen of all places. And I started learning to play the piano from the age of 8. So that's where the journey got going. The classical music was ye olde granddad with Beethoven into Bontempi organs and into little pianos. through school, I did all my grades. I had a great piano teacher eventually called Alicja Fedykiewicz, who is a Polish classical pianist who is the head of piano at Cheetham's Music School in Manchester, which is quite a big deal. And she took me on as a pupil, which is also quite a big deal. I didn't realize at the time, but she was brilliant. She taught me brilliant technique and took me through my grades. Unfortunately for my mother, though, around the age of 15, I discovered synthesizers. When I was 11, 12, I've been listening to Jean-Michel Jarre. And then I think Howard Jones had come out with like his version of synths and things, and Depeche Mode, obviously. 1983, MIDI was invented. It's very important tech for music. And MIDI was a way of joining musical instruments together. You could layer synthesizers, you could synchronize with drum machines, you know, and it was this super combined, and interestingly, for our times to discuss later, a way of combining lots of manufacturers like Roland and Kurzweil and you name them, they all came together and they agreed a standard, oh my God, you know, as manufacturers that could allow keyboards to talk to each other. I was aware of MIDI. And these shops were opening up in Manchester selling synths that were like MIDI synths. And so of a weekend, instead of going around hanging around bus stops and loitering and smoking, I would be a massive nerd and go down to A1 Music in Manchester and go and fondle these expensive keyboards I couldn't afford and dream dreams about being in bands and things. Eventually, as in all good stories, I think Kanye's got the same story, whatever we think of Kanye, but his grandmother changed his life by buying him, I think, a multi-track recorder or something. My grandmother, my little North Manchester grandmother, Peggy Smith, fantastic lady, she should see my eyes bulging at the thoughts of these like synthesizers. And she bought me a synthesizer for Christmas. And that was like, it changed my life. So little Granny Smith, who had no idea about any of it, just went, oh, Andrew seems like he really wants to do this. And so my mother was like, oh, it's too expensive. But lo and behold, instead of playing Bach and Mozart and, you know, all the old favorites, suddenly I was there and I had this polyphonic Bit 99, it was called, by this Italian company, by Krumar, polyphonic MIDI synthesizer. And I remember it was just like orgy for the ears. I remember sitting there for hours with this thing and I would just sit there and I would just like make these. My favorite thing was like string sounds, like long attack and mournful decay. And I would just sit there for bloody hours, like playing these string sounds on this synth, and eventually got into programming. I think that's where everything started. So without getting into War and Peace about it all, that's how it all got going. I then joined a bunch of bands, started playing keyboards in bands, much of my mother's distress, but actually did quite well very quickly. Manchester was bouncing with music in the mid to late 80s. There was people like Graham Massey doing 808 State. There was the Stone Roses. There was a Hacienda nightclub. There was Tony Wilson. There was Factory Records. It was all going off. And that was a very exciting place to be a young musician because you not only were a musical, but you also thought, wow, right next door to me, there's Tony Wilson, Factory, there's New Order. Very inspirational. I joined a band called Robinson, and we actually got a publishing deal with BMG. They gave us 20 grand, the idiots. We recorded a single, bought this old crosstown bus and converted into this like gypsy sharabank where you could sleep on the bus as well as travel around, right? So we did a UK tour of this single that we recorded, which went really well, actually. And bizarrely, we ended up on The Word. And to Miroquois' first ever UK performance was on The Word when he just got signed to Sony. He turned up in this open-top Mercedes with loads of hot ladies around him. We turned up in this knackered old crosstown bus with like its own wood stove boiler in it. And we played on The Word. And that recording actually resurfaced this year. If you go on my Instagram, there's some guy going through Terry Christian's archive at the moment. And you can see a clip of yours truly at the tender age of 18. On The Word with implausibly long hair playing this little snippet of the song that we did. Unfortunately, that was very addictive because within minutes of going, I'm in a band, I was in a band on telly and my mum was going, oh, he's on telly, you know. And it was like, God, I'm hooked now, I'm done, you know.
Yeah.
And the first really interesting thing, though, that happened was while I was doing that, I was still lurking around my old college and a guy who happened to be in my orbit was a young gentleman called Guy Garvey. And Guy Garvey was in this band called Soft. Terrible bloody name, but they were called Soft. And they were doing, at the time, they were quite funky. They were kind of like trying to do stereo MCs and like funky Hammond organy stuff, right? And they were all 16, 17 and clueless, but very ambitious and nice. Made friends with Guy. And basically, as I was learning things in the studio, like recording, like, you know, with budgets and proper computers and reel-to-reel, I was passing down this info to Guy going, this is what we need to do, actually get a tape, go to a studio, record it, you know, make duplicates. benefits from it. And so I ended up mentoring Elbow before they were Elbow, basically, when they were still a bunch of spotty Herberts in North Manchester. I wasn't ever really their manager. I was their sort of sidekick friend. I lent them some keyboards. I gave them encouraging pep talks. I used to turn them to rehearsals and help them produce songs for recording and stuff. And then eventually ended up helping them produce the Noise Box EP. So a very good friend of mine, who's unfortunately died quite a few years ago now, Steve Lloyd, used to run a studio in Manchester called Noise Box. He was a bass player in my band. And we took Guy and the band in. And the first thing they did as Elbow, because they changed the name from Soft, thank God, was this Noise Box EP, which had a track called Powder Blue on it. I played Selena Strings on that track as a friend. We made CD-ROM duplicates of it because everybody was sending tapes. We were like, oh, everybody does tapes. I had a PC and my mate Si Basto had a PC with a CD burner on it. Ta-da. And so what we did is, very precociously, I taught Guy into turning into this production line where we made 100 of these Noise Box EPs as CD-ROMs. And he gave one to Mark Radcliffe in Manchester and the rest is history. Yeah, it was good, right?
Wow.
That was a good trick. And so he trotted off and got signed to V2 and then not signed to V2, unfortunately for them. They got asked around by V2 Records. And I found myself weirdly, having traversed the boards as a musician, I got a day job because it wasn't paying, my music was not paying the bills. I got a day job at City Life magazine in Manchester, which was like Time Out at the time. And they got me on board as the online marketing manager because at Manchester University, I'd been using the internet a lot and the internet pre-World Wide Web, right? The university had to be thanked for that because they very enlightened, even in the Arts and Humanities department where I had, they put computers in. And so everybody was on these Mac LCs and Quadras in these clusters in super old school. And you were using like Gopher and Telnet and then NCSA Mosaic and stuff, like, you know, super old steam-powered internet stuff. I had an email address. And was like, what's that? And what's the dot? And what's the ampersand? And there were only 50,000 email addresses in the world when I had an email address first time around. I mean, can you believe that, right? That this was true, right? Anyway, so I got foisted into this actually news City Life gig. And then the phone started ringing because everybody needed people with internet skills. And it was like massive feast or famine, you know, and in London, they were screaming for people. So I got headhunted, bizarrely. And the headhunter said, you've got to come to London immediately. So I went from this like cheap, very poorly paid job in Manchester to literally overnight tripling my wage, going working in this startup in London called AnswerThink, which was in Gray's Inn Road in Theobald's Road, becoming much more involved in the internet. And then a year went by in that job, where I'd already, you know, it was too cool for school. I got another call. This time it was from major players saying, we've got a record label who would like to talk to you. And I was like, really? And it turns out it was EMI. And EMI were looking for new media people. EMI were looking for new media people who had experience with music, who had experience with the internet. And without even trying or machinating or doing anything, I was just in the right place at the right time. And I went through my interview at EMI and got the gig. And then within 3 months, I was working with David Bowie's team on BowieNet, launching Now That's What I Call Music Online, Sir George Martin web chat, Sir Paul McCartney auctions on Dot Music, blah, 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 blah. You couldn't make it up, really. And that was another stage of the journey.
Every piece of the jigsaw there, it's very condensed, but it makes complete sense because of your passion for this overlap between culture and technology, because of your background in music, your love for the internet. When I read about you becoming the CTO of Massive Attack, this was such a statement in terms of a band actually having that direct relationship with technology. Could you talk a bit about your life from EMI and working with all these legends of the industry to working with Massive Attack, the pioneers in this new digital world?
It's related because at EMI in 99, they were the first band, because Virgin was bought by EMI Records back in the old days, and they were on Virgin on Circa, and my old mentor, Ray Cooper, had signed them on Circa Records with Ashley, who ended up at Sony. They were the first band to stream a full album in its entirety in 99, which was Mezzanine. It was interesting because I didn't know them then. My friend Danny Van Emden used to manage their online stuff for Virgin. So they were pioneers, really, like super fast, like Bowie, because David had done this website with a fan-only access in the mid-90s already, like mid-late 90s, BowieNet. And he'd also done this avatar chat-based web interface called Bowie World, where you could download it and become this 3D avatar and walk around like VR chat now, but 25 years ago, walk around inside a VR world with Bowie GIFs and artwork on the walls. And Massive Attack and Bowie and also Peter Gabriel were three of the most innovative people at the time in that scene, I think. Anyway, after EMI, I went and ran off and had some wilderness years with a really amazing guy called Mick Rock. And I met Mick Rock through, yes, David Bowie. So Mick Rock was the photographer for Bowie. He did all the classic Ziggy, and then he took Lou Reed, Transformer, Iggy Pop, Raw Power, Queen 2. You know, he was like super photographer. And at the time, I kind of got a bit disillusioned with the internet because it was kind of a nightmare. After Napster, it got quite litigious and it wasn't as much fun, especially in online. So Mick sort of like got me to join the circus. He said, oh, come and work with me and we'll do photography of bands and run around the world doing books and exhibitions. I went, yeah, all right. So I did that for a while. And that was interesting because I met a lot of interesting characters doing that. But what led me squarely to the door of Massive Attack was after that, I stopped working with Mick after about 4 or 5 years. I got really interested in this thing that had turned up in 2008 called Second Life. And Second Life was a virtual world. Yes. And Suzanne Vega, interestingly, was a musician. He was the first musician to play a gig in Second Life as an avatar of herself in 2008. Wow. And I was like, wow, because I love Suzanne Vega. And I was like, wow. And she was like this avatar. And people could throw money at her at the gigs as avatars, right? And you could have like custom guitars and clothes and houses. They even did a sort of progenitor of Bitcoin called Lindens. And you could basically buy Lindens because the company that made it was called Linden Lab. And you could convert real money into Lindens and use virtual currency, right? Which I think was where a lot of Bitcoin thinking came from, to be honest. Anyway, because I got into virtual worlds, I got into game engines as well. So what was slowly appearing were these 3D game engines, which were like these physics-based virtual 3D model engines with animation. You could basically create worlds like Second Life. You could apply the audio. You could create avatars and things. My interests and my tastes sort of became converged. We'd done music. We'd done electronic music. We'd done electronic production and music production. Then we'd done record labels and internet. Then we did analog photography, but I did do a lot of digital photography with Mick with the first time around. And then we did game engine 3D immersive worlds. Right? And that's where I was sat by 2009-10. So basically, the virtual worlds led me to the door of Ray Cooper, who's an old mentor of mine at EMI Virgin. Ray had retired, and one of his friends, Tony Michaelides, Tony the Greek, had moved to Florida. Tony the Greek, he used to be a radio DJ in Manchester in the late 80s, actually. One of the first guys to play the Stone Roses on national radio. Tony had gone to retire, and he'd met this guy called Ronnie Abovitz. And Ronnie was a founder of a company called Magic Leap. And Magic Leap were making augmented reality glasses. So basically, I got press ganged into, come and work with Magic Leap because you're a nerd and you know what they're talking about and we don't. So I came along and I was basically the fluffer for everyone to try and talk to music label people who were going, what? And I was going, mixed reality. And they were going, what? And they were going, game engines, you know, motion capture, spatial sound. And they were going, what? And I was constantly sort of evangelizing for this stuff. And whilst heavily evangelizing, Ray introduced me to two people, very key. One was Mark Pickin, Massive Attack's manager, and the other one was Derek Burkitt, Björk's manager. And basically, both of those men foolishly allowed me to speak to their artists about mixed reality and immersive media. And Björk totally got it, and she was already interested in VR. And then Robert Del Naya, Daddy G wasn't particularly, he's not particularly interested in tech. Daddy G likes his music, but he's not as much of a nerd as Rob is. So Rob and I became friends and started exchanging riffs and licks and ideas about tech. And this was 2014, quite a long time ago now. Initially, we were looking at how could you use Magic Leap tech and how would music work on Magic Leap tech and what would it be and blah, blah, blah. But quickly moved around. We're quite similar in some ways in the sense he's got like raging ADHD like I have. He likes his stuff, but he also likes lots of diverse, broad stuff, and he funnels it all in and out. And I think that's a parable of our times, to be honest. Be more ADHD, you know. We started talking about procedural game environments because of the game engine narrative. We were like saying, well, if music comes into these glasses, how does that work? And where's the convergence? Well, the convergence is that to make these worlds work, you have to have a game engine, and the game engine controls the glasses, right? And so what do game engines do? Well, at the moment, games have these soundtracks like Grand Theft Auto and things like that, where based on the mood and the tempo of the game, the soundtrack can change and the song reflects the vibe or the antithesis of the vibe to try and calm you down or speed you up, right? And we looked at that. And so we did a few experiments. And one of them was there was this game jam called Ludum Dare. And it still goes. And it's basically a connected, independent group of game developers or indie game developers. And Ludum Dare is kind of like, you know, who dares wins vibe. And what they do is they vote on a monthly basis for a theme for a game. And so the entire community vote and they pick a theme. And then at the end of that month, they have a game jam. And for 48 hours, they have to make a game, a wireframe of a demo of a game based on the theme that they all voted for, right? And the idea is you've got 48 hours, lots of pressure, to come up with a playable demo of your game idea. So I've been looking at this anyway, because I was thinking with Magic Leap was, we need some nerds. We cannot just deal with music people. We have to have the new voice in the room has to be people who know how to make video games and soundtracks for games, things like that. So Rob, very enlightened, we took a bunch of unused audio stems from Massive Attack sessions that had not made the grade for songs. We bundled them up under a Creative Commons attribution license, a CC3. We said to the Ludum Dare organizer, give this to your game people, because the one thing that they're not doing, we noticed, is they're not doing any music for their demo games. They've not got anything to use. So we're going to give you all these Creative Commons Massive Attack pieces, and they can slot them in, if they fit, into their game. And that went down a storm. I mean, Notch, interestingly, the guy who programmed Minecraft even gave us a thumbs up for that one on Twitter at the time. And that was the beginning of Rob and I starting to really mess around with this idea of composition in a game engine environment for mixed reality, really. As a result of that, we built this app called Phantom. Johnny Ive, dun-dun-dun, for it is he, is a mate of Rob Del Naja's, obviously, because they both like Bauhaus, obviously. In 2015, the band were in San Francisco, and we got Johnny and his team of engineers turned up from Apple to the gig. We had a lovely time with them and ended up with a raucous, wild San Franciscan night, which ended up in Russian Hill. But the day after, nursing some substantial hangovers, myself, you and the keyboard player from Massive Attack and a couple of others, we were invited to the Infinite Loop Apple headquarters, which was the old headquarters where Steve had been. And Johnny and his engineers basically went, oh, look at this new thing we've got. And it was the watch. It was before the watch came out. And it was like, oh, this is an Apple watch. And so we were like, oh, and we were super hungover anyway, but it was funny. But what was really amazing was watching all the engineers and how Apple worked. It's like being inside the Wizard of Oz kind of thing. He came out with this thing saying, oh, we'd really like to do something that's not fitness with the watch. Can you have a think about what that could be? Rob being Rob and me being me, we went off and thought about what that could be. And what we realized was that if you could hold somebody's heart rate on the watch, you've got a beat and you've got tempo. And so if you've got a beat and a tempo, what else can you do? Well, you can start making some rules to say that if my heartbeat goes to here, play this. And if my heartbeat goes to there, play that. So we ended up concocting this app called Phantom, and I found a developer and also a guy called Robert Thomas to help us think this through. With a lot of help from Apple, actually, they gave us some watches and various other things. We built a prototype of this app called Phantom. And the first thing he did was we used Massive Attack and Young Fathers, who are friends of the band, another band called Young Fathers. And we built the first version of this app, and the app was basically supposed to be a synthesis of what these glasses were going to be, because the glasses didn't exist. We write, went, well, what's the nearest thing to a pair of glasses? It's the iPhone with a watch, right? And so we took the heart rate off from the watch and the wrist movement, because it's got a compass in it, axis accelerometer. We took the time of day, time of flight, emotion. We took the camera signal, what you were doing on the screen. We had a touchscreen face and the camera. And we embedded all those data points into an app and fused them into this app called Phantom. And the idea, we had to build a rule kit. And the rule kit was, if it's this time of day and the heart rate is this, then play this string sound. If it's this, then do that. We had to build a bunch of rules to basically start playing back these stems of Massive Attack songs in a way that still sounded like Massive Attack. So we would have some cute things like when ARKit came out, if you looked at the camera phone and smiled, Liz would start singing. And if you didn't smile, Liz would stop singing. And, you know, some little cute things where basically the person using the app was remixing the songs using all the sensors off the phone and the watch. But we also obviously did some things with emotion and triggering feedback loops, which but pleasing and interesting, you know, using AR and things like that. And so that was one of the things we did with Massive Attack, and that kind of broke the mold in some ways because everybody sort of looked at him and went, well, what is that even? And to be honest, interestingly, even now, 10 years after the effect, I think Phantom will probably come back in some way or another. At the time, it was very much an art house, this could be the future kind of experiment, but there was no way to make any money out of it because, for instance, none of the music companies knew how to monetize stems at the time. This was 2015. It just looked at us as if you'd shown a dog a card trick. You're like, what? You know? So we didn't bother with that one. And then the complexity of Massive Attack was so deep in the sense of that album that we couldn't charge for it because the publishing was a nightmare because we were a collective, right? So we had to do it as a free of charge thing, and Universal gave us, you know, the go-ahead to do that. That was one of the experiments. And then the other thing with Massive Attack was that around the same time we came up to this 20th anniversary of Rob and the band having launched Mezzanine, the label were going, oh, let's repackage, remaster, you know, remix, and all the usual stuff the labels do. And he was like, oh, God, you know, let's do something a bit more interesting than that, can't we? So I've been looking around because of our interest in climate change. Offsetting is the wrong word. Ameliorating is a better word. The impacts of climate change. We were looking at things like low carbon touring, low carbon events. We were looking at how does the band reduce emissions? How can we promote, you know, the agenda of trying to reduce the impacts of music industry on the world and do our bit? Part of that led me to do a bunch of research into data storage, obviously. And data storage takes up energy at the moment. And you need to burn things to spin wheels, to make steam, to create electricity, to power servers. So I've been looking at these inert data storage media types. And there was a couple of candidates. One was this little silica disc. So silica, obviously, made out of sand, glass disc. University of Southampton, a guy called, Peter Kazansky was his name. He'd been taught by the godfather of lasers, the Russian guy who invented lasers, whose name escapes me, unfortunately. Anyway, he created this process for writing data onto these little discs. You would use a femto laser to create these lattices inside the disc, and it would create a very high-density storage medium that was passive. It didn't need to be spun all the time. It could be archived. And everybody was going, well, that's good, because you don't need to use loads of energy for the memory banks of the internet, which is growing daily, you know, et cetera. So I looked at that. But then this other thing caught my eye, and it was storing data in synthetic DNA. So DNA stores a lot of data, right? I mean, you and I, for instance, we are the products of the data that DNA can store, as is everybody listening to this, unless there's any non-humans listening to this. In which case, I thought, well, that's interesting. So I went and approached the guys doing it. They were at ETH Zurich, the research-led institution there in Zurich. A guy called Professor Robert Grass was running this company called Turbo Beads. His game end was to really authenticate, bizarrely, things like Parmesan cheese and wine and all these products that are getting bootlegged, right? He was going to inject synthetic DNA into them to go proof of origin, right? But at the time, I came to him and I said, well, could we put an album into DNA? And he went, yeah, I think we could do that in a kind of Swiss-German accent. So what we did is we, implausibly, we took the stereo full-fat master, 44K master of Mezzanine. We compressed it, the hell out of it, down to about 20 megs using an old Dolby codec. It still sounded good enough. It's like a Dolby audio telephonic codec. Still sounded good enough for 20 megs to give them. And then they sequenced the binary audio into the GATC sequence for DNA and created a synthetic DNA molecule of the audio, as you do. Then they cloned it millions and millions of times and then inserted it into these little glass beads, sense the turbo beads thing, because DNA degenerates over time, right? As an organic compound. Then Robert, being Robert, decided, the final piece of the puzzle is, ta-da, to inject the millions of copies of the album into two-pack spray paint. So Robert Del Naya was in the 80s, was a hip-hop DJ, graffiti artist, hanging out with people like Banksy and various others in Bristol. And obviously a lot of his invective in his artworks is based around spray paint. And he thought it was jolly funny to use DNA of the band's album inside spray paint, because when he used spray paint, he'd be leaving behind, a bit like a dog leaving a message behind and it's cocking a leg. He'd be able to leave millions of copies of Mezzanine everywhere by spraying it on the walls and on his artworks. So we did that. Tom Hingston, who designed the Mezzanine album artwork, did a can, really lovely design can, one in black and one in white. We got a wallpaper award for best canned album. Now, these are some of the adventures that a CTO of Massive Attack does. We were just trying to find new ways to tell the same stories, which is, instead of some mystical thing, we were trying to find ways to illustrate systems thinking around sustainability, around how can you sustain human agency, how can you merge technology in a humanist way with music and arts, and try and find the ghost in the machine or the heart inside the tin man, if you like. Because for all of the rampant tech innovation, at the heart of it, there's still us, fleshy meat puppets that we are. And, you know, with all our hopes, dreams and desires. And so my job, I suppose, has been at this inflection point between the technology and the art and the music, really, which I've also then taken forward into my own work. So one of the things is, beyond massive name dropping of Massive Attack and Bjork and Bowie, being a man of a certain age and my own ideas, I've recently been synthesizing some of these things into some of my own work, which interestingly next year is going to evolve into a capital of culture in Oulu in northern Finland, commissioned me to do a piece of sound art, and which I've called the Logos. And again, at this inflection point between tech and art, I'm going to be sonifying billions of year old radio bursts from the other side of the universe into audio playback, into sonifications that are going to play every day at the same time inside this huge, beautiful 18th century cathedral in Oulu, northern Finland. And we are going to get the philosopher Timothy Morton to some meditations and some words. We're going to get professor of astrophysics at MIT, Kiyoshi Masui, to write some new words about physics and our place in the universe. And then the dean of the cathedral, a lady called Satu Saarinen, is going to write some theologically inspired narratives around this idea of these very, very weak signals coming from incredibly far away that are still perceptible by humans. So that's so the inspiration of people I've worked with has now fermented itself into doing my own stuff more vociferously. And yes. And it's been interesting because just to manifest those things and to be inspired by those people, you can be very intimidated by those people in some ways, but you can also be very inspired by them. And the latter is true. The former was true at first, and then the latter is true now. And I suppose with regard to this conversation we're having, this New Year's revolution, evolution. One of the things I feel at the Logos and also the works of the people I've been fortunate enough to work with is you're just trying to define what it is to be human and to keep that signal and to reduce the noise. And the signal to noise ratio is a good nerdy narrative arc to talk about, because I'm all about maintaining the signal, because especially now with AI and generative AI and, you know, the to be or not to be of what it is to be human when everything's written for you and everything's played for you and everything's filmed for you. How do you maintain the human spark in that? And how do you keep a sense of our cultural identity alive when it's being so rapidly ingested and exported and ingested and exported?
Yeah, you open up a whole can of worms there. Thank you for taking us through all of those different scenarios, man. It's like the stuff at Massive Attack, utterly mind-blowing. My goodness. And the project with Logos next year, I think a lot of people are going to be tuning into that. It's such a kind of poignant metaphor for where we kind of find ourselves as humanity. You mentioned climate change there earlier. We had Claire O'Neill from AGF on the podcast talking about the Massive Attack collaboration in great detail. So we will link to that in the show notes. But I love the way that you're actually looking at this potentially this inflection point in human history where, you know, you've been a part of all of these technology revolutions leading up for now. You've seen the most inspiring, the most impactful, and now you're actually looking at it in this age of generative AI as actually this could be something entirely different. Could you take us through your view on where we stand now with generative AI? Because I know you're actually kind of, you know, charting a different course. You're not just taking it all on the chin. You're not taking it for granted. You're actually seeing what's happening and you are charting a course to the future. So talk to us a bit about the world in 2026 and this New Year's revolution.
I think what occurred to me this year, as I had the great fortune to go to a bunch of music events to travel around Europe. So I went to Reeper Barn Festival in Hamburg, where they all talk about dance music a lot. And then I went to Amsterdam Dance Event, where they all talk about dance music a lot. Similar to In the City in Manchester in the 80s, 90s, which Tony Wilson coined to get the industry to talk about issues of the day and to have, you know, wizened people discuss things on panels and come to some conclusion, hopefully some conclusions at some point, mixed with live music and bands playing and all that kind of good stuff. I went to a couple of these things, and I also joined the Association for Electronic Music this year. So I'm now a member of the AFEM. Whilst there, I made some good friends at the Association for Electronic Music, and Finlay and Jay, who are my main homeboys there, basically were introducing me to these narratives that I'd kind of been on the fringes of. Because to be very candid, in 2017-18, I was already looking at AI with Rob, and we looked at AI and we looked at Deep Dream initially, and we did a bunch of artworks based on Deep Dream imagining Massive Attack artwork. And we also did some work, we chatted to a bunch of people like DeepMind, about what they were doing, and also Google, what they were doing about AI. And we were aware of a couple of things like Magenta, which was a project by Google, Google Magenta, which is all about composition and style transfer and composition and MIDI. And we were also aware of DeepMind doing projects on things like WaveNet with Google. And WaveNet now seems to have been what 11 Labs has turned into. WaveNet was, give me a minute of audio and I can make a clone of your voice. And at the time, that was seen as fairly nuclear, sensitively coordinated to not be released software because they all went, we're not ready for it, right? But now it appears we are. I don't know what changed. But we were already aware of what was going on then. And Rob and I kind of steered away from it a bit because whilst making Mezzanine in the Phantom app, it became fairly obvious that what we were starting to discuss was the itness of an artist. Because while we were creating these rules to pull these stems together at runtime in this app, we were having to say, this bass line and this string section should never not play together. This vocal always needs to happen with this drum. Otherwise, it doesn't sound enough like the song, you know? And so we realized what we were building was a pattern language description, a canonical descriptor, if you like, mathematically, of massive attack itness, right? As a formula. And I said to Rob, you know, obviously where this leads is you end up with building a model of massive attack is an AI. And what happens then is that AI can then be sequenced to just play massive attack songs all day long without you guys being involved. And we kind of went, whoa, I don't know if we're ready for that one. And we pedaled furiously away from that because it was, you know, to have been the, what do they call it? The Judas sheep? Basically, when the lambs go to slaughter, right? There's one of them that is trained by the shepherd to be the one that leads them all to slaughter. And it's called the Judas sheep. Anyway, what we didn't want to be was be this character that's going to go, hey, everyone, let's all put all our audio onto AI so that AI can just generate music without you. So we went, no, we're not going to do that. So I pedaled furiously away, and so did Rob, and we didn't think about it much more. And then the whole crypto thing happened. We were like, oh, we're definitely not doing that. I was hanging around with these quite downtrodden, mopey Germans in the Reeperbahn Festival, and a couple of them were working for Fraunhofer Institute, which is this nerdy audio industrial thing that reinvented MP3s, interestingly. But they were all going, oh, we're all doomed. And I was like, going, what? He goes, yeah, you know, everybody's already had their catalog scraped and all the models are done. You might as well just close the shop and go home because the music industry is knackered because of the AI. And I was like, what? I was going, yeah, well, you know, if you've not been scraped by now, are you even relevant, you know? So I was like, oh, this is a bit downbeat, you know? And the thing is, you can't do anything to protect your music because if you put any protections on, the AI learns the protection and strips it off. And I was like, oh, bloody hell, this is a bit grim, you know, yeah. Ever-decreasing circles. Anyway, unaccustomed as I am to being a pain in the backside, I said, I'm not accepting this sitting down, no. I was saying, we need to just regroup and come back and be stronger, you know? So I then went to ADE and I heard the same invective, which was like, oh, there's all these deep fakes on DSPs, on Spotify and Apple. Everybody's Deezer's taking down as many deep fakes in a day as I've had hot dinners in my life, etc. And I was like, oh, God. So I started doing some work and researching what the opportunities may be. Now, in my early days at EMI, they brought in various demos of how to stop people file sharing. So in the days of Napster and LimeWire, the music industry's response was, right, how do we stop this? How do we stop piracy? So one of the ways to do it was a thing called DRM, Digital Rights Management. And DRM, in its first wave, was quite brutal. What Steve Jobs did, and I remember this very well, was in 2000, he did a huge poster campaign around London, which had rip, mix, burn written across the top of the poster. And what he was possibly suggesting was that you might want to use your new iMac with its CD drive to rip your CD collection and put them onto his new shiny iPod. Unfortunately, the terms and conditions of you having a CD didn't include you making copies of that CD beyond fair use, right? And so everybody was ripping their CDs, but they weren't just making CDs. They were putting them on file sharing programs, right? And then suddenly there was this huge existential morass in the music industry going, oh my God, we're all knackered because no one's buying CDs. They're all sharing files, all the teenagers. And so there was this huge rearguard action to put digital rights management on things. Anyway, to a greater or lesser extent, that didn't really work. And the only thing that did sort of save the music industry in inverted commas, I think, was streaming became more of an option as bandwidth increased. So as bandwidth increased, domestic internet boring but important plumbing, it became easier to stream music and also easier to download music. So Apple very quickly stole a march on all the major labels, came up with iTunes and managed within two clicks, I want the song, I download the song, I want the song, I don't, really easy, super low friction. So that kind of saved the first wave of disappointment that the internet gave to the rights owners. And then streaming came along and Universal, Lucian Grange and a guy who used to be my peer at Universal called Rob Wells, did a deal with this company that only a few people had heard of called Spotify. And they did a deal with Spotify. And I started using Spotify pretty early, I have to say. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. It's like the Celestial Jukebox. And do you want to hear about the Celestial Jukebox?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
My second interview at EMI with a guy called Fergal Gara and a guy called Mike McNally.
I remember them well. Yes.
Yeah. They sat there and they said, oh, we want you to present your ideas on the future of the internet and music. And I was like, oh, okay. So I'd been reading New Media Age, which is like the Bible at the time for all the nerds in London. And I'd been on mp3.com and I'd used Real Player. I'd built some websites for Elbow and various other things using Real Networks, which was like a forerunner streaming standard. And my hypothesis was there's going to be this thing called the Celestial Jukebox. And this is 1999. And in a few years' time, you'll have all of the music ever recorded available for you on demand from the Celestial Jukebox. And they all looked at me as if to say, you are off your rocker. But anyway, we're going to take you on and see where it leads. And I was like, okay. Anyway, fast forward to the future. This Celestial Jukebox has been very effective because let's zoom right to present day. My research led me to the understanding that what's been happening is that these companies like Suno and Udio have been using Chrome, the browser, as a headless version of Chrome. So you turn it into an engineering unit rather than a browser, right? And a headless version of Chrome has been programmed to scrape YouTube en masse. And they created a program to basically just in volumes with where you just set the computer running for, I don't know, 2 months straight or whatever. And it just goes through all of the different versions of everything and sticks them on a hard drive. So they basically scraped. It's the equivalent of YouTube. Some guy at YouTube coming home one day going, hey, this is all of YouTube on a hard drive. Because you can't buy one of those things. Imagine if you could buy one of those things. We'd all be done, right? The job done. What these guys have done, these Suno and Udio guys have done, is they've written a software that's basically compromised Chrome. And then YouTube didn't have enough defenses against this activity to stop them doing it. So they've scraped all of YouTube, built these models without any consent or copyright and not worrying about that. The models they've started using to generate music. Then something strange has happened. Now, we'll go into this only delicately because I think it's a massive can of worms, this. But certain organizations, should we say, and also financial institutions and also individuals seem to have thought at some point that it'd be worth funding these challengers who these criminals basically have stolen music, funding them very well to go off and make a business. And I think the trouble is that they use the same model as YouTube used in the first place. YouTube amassed a $1 billion war chest and they said, right, we know that copyright is going to be infringed. People are going to upload stuff to YouTube that is not theirs. So what we'll do is we'll have a moat, and the defensive moat for us will be we can pay for lawyers to go, sorry, 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 sorry for forever and a day with $1 billion. And by the time everybody's lost their shirt with legal action, we'll just go, ipso facto, we are YouTube and we've won. It was the same thing Uber did, right? It's a very standard business model for certain companies. And OpenAI have done the same thing. OpenAI casually funded through the back teeth by Microsoft, interestingly. So when everybody talks about OpenAI, OpenAI are actually Microsoft, because Microsoft went, here, have all these Azure tokens to do your stuff, right? And this is very in-depth for your audience, I think. But anyway, the point being is that unlike the poor guy who came up with Napster who had no money, Sean Fanning, these guys are all armed to the teeth with acres of cash, right? And so what's happening is the old industry is being undermined, and Suno and Udio are doing to the music industry what they think Napster and also iTunes, Apple Music, did to the old music industry. It was a massive shakedown, you know? You aren't doing this well enough, so we'll do it. And we'll become the new kings of all we survey, right? So I was there going, well, that's fine, but what you're undoing there is the fundamental tenet of copyright as a creative person. You're saying that doesn't matter. And you're saying that it's okay. And everybody's guilty of this. Meta have been found to have been downloading all these jailbroken books from Anna's archive, which has made the Llama model. The only people who really suck at AI are Apple, and that's because they don't go around breaching everybody's copyright, right? So that's why their AI sucks, because they don't go around breaching everybody's copyright. Because AI to work needs you to basically say, suspend any disbelief you've got in copyright and go, you know, have all my books, have all my films, have all my music. Feel free, fill your boots. And maybe I'll get some scraps thrown to me from the table when you're raking it in, you know, which is a terrible equation. So I set my brain working to trying to find a solution. So I set up this company called Genotone, and it comes from the word genotype, from the idea of DNA, a genotype, your genes. And my proviso, my hypothesis is thus, just in music, because I can't deal with anything else, because it's bad enough being me as it is, right? But there's only one life. So I went, right, what can we do? What can we do? What can we do? So because of my interest in audio, I am aware of a thing called watermarking. So the first time I came across watermarks was posh paper. So Basil & Bond paper, you know, bonded writing paper. You hold it up to the light and there's the BB sign going, oh, I'm posh, I've got posh paper, right? That's watermark. Watermarks are an ancient art form as a result of printing where people were able to authenticate the paper stuff was printed on. Very interesting. So watermarking technology has also been embedded in videos. There's a company called Digimart was doing it in the 90s for VHS and DVDs. So they watermarked stop piracy. And so you could tell where something came from, right? And audio has also got its form of watermarking. Now, watermarking in audio, originally, very interestingly for me, in the old days when radio was king, there was a thing called the chart return system. And when you released a single, when a DJ played a song on the radio, Raja, which was the company that monitored the chart returns, they would have a system in place where at the radio station, they would monitor how many plays of a record were done by that radio station. And all those plays would go into the hat at the end of the week, and it would give you a relative chart position based on sales of vinyl, CD, whatever, and then plays, right? To enable this in the 90s, because I was in a band, I knew about this, what you did at mastering with your dad is you had to embed an audio chirp into the song. And so when the song was played by the DJ, this little chirp would go, blip, like a little sonic blip. And that little sonic blip was your identification. It was to say that this is your song. It's been played today by the BBC at 3:02. In it goes into the hat for the chart returns. So having remembered that, I went, I wonder if we could do something similar for music in this era of AI. But instead of it being like a for the chart return service, it's a watermark that's embedded into your audio, but you can't hear it. And there's a technical term for that. It's psychoacoustic embedding. So you psychoacoustically embed the audio. And what that means is a computer looks at the waveform of the audio, a bit like Shazam, right? And it goes, where can I stuff this audio so that you're not going to hear it? In here, up here, down there, where am I going to put it? And fold it, a bit like weaving. Can I fold it into the audio so you can't hear it, right? So I was looking around and there's a bunch of tech that's done that for 20 years, right? And to great lesser degrees of success. But it now, because of the speed of computing and also the evolution of maths and computing, it's now a lot better than it used to be. So you can hide this audio very effectively in relatively real time. So I've set up this company called Genotone. I applied for some mad professor patents that I dreamt up one night in a fever dream. Those include some of the things I learned from Massive Attack's DNA project. They also include some of the things I learned from Massive Attack's Phantom project. And they also include some things I learned from signal processing. So the idea, the big idea at the moment is that companies like Deezer and Apple Music are dealing with millions of tracks of deep fake and also generative AI music, and they have no provenance. So there's all problems with that, which is organized crime is using them, Spotty Herbert's passing themselves off are using them, and they're monetizing them, right? So what I've proposed with Genotone is that we create an embedded audio, cryptographically secure data layer into your music that is referenced with an ID that is only you, like your passport. And when you upload some music to a DSP, a Spotify, Deezer, Apple Music, that audio signifier has to be present. And if it's not present, it just doesn't go in. And what you do by doing that in one fell swoop is you get rid of all the slop, because the slop is unattributable and it's got no provenance. So I've set up this project called Genotone as an open standard for musicians, not for record labels or tech companies or Spotify and Deezer. A musician owns their own identity. It's not sold to them or licensed to them or rented to them. It's free. The person distributing the music has to pay a license to use the software we develop to prove that the artist's song is theirs, because they are constitutionally obliged now legally from next year, to show that artists and music have provenance before going into their system. So I'm now sitting, bizarrely, I'm sitting on this committee in Whitehall, being convened by DCMS, the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, to talk about standards for AI. And I am, it would appear, the lone voice at the table representing a bunch of people in the UK, about 30,000 musicians at the moment through the people I'm working with, to try and bring this in as a standard where artists will be able to get their ID, similar protocols to banking. You know, when you do the passport and your 3D face thing you do, it's locked into you. You've got your own ID that only you know have the key for, and nobody else knows your key. That is embedded in your music and it goes into the machine. And if it hasn't got that, then the machine will not accept it. That is not the only answer to this. And it's definitely not a silver bullet, but that stops all the AI slop. So that's what I've been doing. And interestingly, all of these things have convened together, because the final piece of the pudding is that this bizarre patent that I've applied for is informed by my work on working on fast radio bursts. So fast radio bursts are incredibly faint audio signals that are sub 5 milliseconds and have originally the power of 1 million nuclear explosions, but they've traveled for 9 billion years across interstellar space, and a radio telescope on the planet can still get a signal, right? So I thought, well, if you can travel across 9 billion years of interstellar space and I can still hear your little radio signal go beep, then we can figure out how to defeat AI.
Phenomenal. Well, thank you for fighting the good fight. We will, of course, be linking to all of your projects in the show notes for the podcast. So if you're listening, if you'd like to get involved, if you can support Andrew and his team and their amazing work, please do reach out and get in touch. But listen, Andrew, I think it'd be informative just to rewind a little bit. And, you know, you're talking about all this AI slop, generative AI, you know, one of the biggest thefts of copyright material in human history. What do you think is currently at stake for humanity with this generative AI tsunami?
Well, it's just Blade Runner. So Blade Runner is the answer. Basically, yes. How do you prove you're a human? And how do you prove we even existed? So what was interesting with the DNA project was that I gave an interview to Wired, and my parting shot was, if all of this stops tomorrow, all of it, maybe because Rob has sprayed his DNA paint everywhere, if an alien species was to land on the planet in 2,000 years' time, they might just uncover a little bit of something, and it might be DNA of mezzanine music, right? That maybe it'll survive. I feel that we're in an era where there's a couple of things going on here, and you have to be culturally sensitive to what's going on and also politically sensitive to what's going on. I would argue the thing that really moved Western culture in the 20th century in music was protest songs. And it was the likes of Woody Guthrie, "This Machine Kills Fascists," you know, and talking about workers' rights. Then it was Dylan talking about a nuclear war and racism. And then it was all the protest songs of the 60s, peace and love, hippie movement. Then it was the punk protest songs in the 70s about racism and political violence. Then in the 80s, it was about Live Aid and Nelson Mandela and all these topics of our time, which were evoked very strongly and clearly by musicians as the troubadours talking about our cares and the things we should think about. I remember U2 being the first band in the 80s to put Amnesty International on their artwork. Joshua Tree had a link to become a member of Amnesty International. And Bono was like, you know, let's do that. That's cool, right? And him and Billy Bragg together were doing these some remarkable things about awareness around political refugees and all these kind of things. And the thing that happens if you homogenize culture through a hose pipe of mediated, mediocre, nonsensical gibberish, and you then denigrate what has been made by humans to the bottom of the pile of all the gibberish that's being squirted at you, is that you lose your cultural connection and your sense of community, your sense of ethics and values, all mediated by this hosepipe of cynical, I think, exhaust fumes from a tech sector that is all about money and hardware and an Ouroboros of finance, not about what it is to be alive in a planet that's being divided and suffering from climate change, suffering from inequality and poverty and injustice, you end up with this Brave New World machine music that's just designed to pacify you and to stop you asking awkward questions. So that's what AI music can do, I think, if we're not careful.
That's a dystopian warning right there. But listen, I'd love to get your thoughts on the kind of role of shared rituals and community and people coming together in this age. Like you say, everyone's at their phones, for very splintered and divided and separated. Talk about coming together as humans, celebrating our shared humanity. How important is this, and what can we do to protect these things?
It's plowshares into swords and swords into plowshares. I think tech is good, right? The technology is as old as we are, and you don't want to run away from it and become a Luddite and live in caves because, you know, things like polio come back and things like tuberculosis come back. And so there's something to be said for the noble savage living in a cave and going back to basics. But I also think that that possibly is reverse engineering going on. I don't know if you want all of that. You know, we all want to go back in time, but we want to have things like electric blankets and a pair of slippers and a toaster and a kettle. You know, you want to go back in time, but you don't want to go back to the ruggedness of it, right? The thing with music is it's always been a great combination and a great accelerator and catalyst. And for my life, it single-handedly, without any shadow of a doubt, led me to meet everybody I've met and do everything I've done. Music is at the heart, fundamentally. If my grandfather hadn't had the grandfatherly wisdom to melt my brain with Beethoven when I was four, would have any of this happened? Who knows? It's the same with any itch you can't scratch. Dancers, painters, poets, writers, any kind of art form that takes you and metastases you out of the humdrum to get away from Maslow's hierarchy of eating, sleeping, and shelter, and doing the finesse thing of expressing yourself in the joy of creation and also the communal practice of creation, right? So community is a bit of a vague idea in some ways. But the idea of using technology to take away central authority and to come together as a community, I think that's an interesting prospect. Now, a lot of people say, oh, that's socialism and communism. It's not. The idea of disintermediation and reducing friction so that you and I can have this come. You know, you and I have never physically met. We met because of the intermediary of the internet, amazing invention, that allows us to be aware of each other's work, allow us to understand we have certain common connected ideas and thoughts and hopes and narratives and appreciation of music specifically, obviously, and your appreciation of audio, which is why we're here. I feel that those tools, used in the right way, are still incredibly powerful. And making music together, bringing people together to make music, from my perspective, because you can do other things, you know, to make music and do sports, you can do whatever the hell you want. The idea of using devices and software to collectively bring together an empathetic union of people is very powerful. And in times of crisis like we're living in, whether real or imagined, whether manufactured or accidental, who's to say, above my pay grade to say, but to bring ourselves together and to share stories and to share narratives, to create things together collectively, to identify and to work through one another's problems through it, to meet new people, to galvanize ourselves. Those are really vital human things to do. And in an era where we're all running around, you know, because God is dead, because we live in a world full of rational science, but is God dead? Don't know, to be discussed. Community spirit, though, which was engendered by churches and all those kind of things we had for 1,000 years and then booted out the window in the last 80 years because of Einstein and radio telescopes and nuclear bombs, those things have been removed, but the requirement for them is still there. We still need to find a way to come together and share and contribute and to feel like we're part of something bigger than ourselves. So I would say that AI and tech and those kind of things, if used in the correct way, are very useful. I think a good analogy is gunpowder. You can use it for blowing people up, but you can also use it for making very nice fireworks.
That's fantastic. My goodness, fireworks. Well, fireworks, we couldn't have a better metaphor. We're here on New Year's Day 2026. Theme of the podcast is, you know, not New Year's resolutions. It's New Year's evolution. It's New Year's revolution. So listen, my final question for you now, Andrew, is talk to us a bit about your hopes for the future. What would you love to see happening in 2026?
There are some really good things happening and that will hopefully be evoked and evolved by 2026. I think everybody is realizing from a musical perspective, we need to have a collective agreement. So the reason I set up Genotone wasn't so I could have the statue on horseback of myself in the town square, Andrew saved the music industry. That's not the gig. The gig was that all I saw was lots of people having separate conversations and that's no use. So I'm doing it as a provocation because I've got a proposal But what's yours? You probably think yours is better. And you think mine's rubbish. But I don't care because I'm going to be in competition with you. And if you don't tell me what your idea is, we won't get any further than me winning. So you don't want me to win. So you come on board as well and we'll have a joined up conversation that creates dynamism and competition to solve a problem. And I think what's happening and what I'm trying to do with Genotone and lots of other people are trying to do with standards and politicians are a mere... 3 to 5 years behind, but doesn't matter, are trying to legislate to bring in protections for musicians and artists, things like that. I feel that next year, I would hope to see a strong framework from a political, boring but important plumbing perspective, that legislation comes in to stop people loading deepfakes onto their networks. Legislation comes in to stop AI companies without paying anybody's copyright fees, to stop them in their tracks from distributing their product until we've sorted it all out. At the moment, we're just letting them do it whilst trying to sort it out at the same time. Seems weird to me. I would put a moratorium on them. And I would hope also that with regards to climate, and I know you were talking to Claire about it, so there's the wheels that have been set in motion by Massive Attack for the Act 1.5 initiative, reducing emissions from events, looking at the whole supply chain and holistic experience of attending events and how we consume culture. I think there's lots of movement going on to try and effectively not force people to do that, but to make it attractive for them to do that and easy for them to do that. And beyond that, I think I'm just hoping that beyond all of the nonsense and the noise that's going on in the media, there seems to be a general purpose emotion now that people are realizing, a bit like when you've smoked too many cigarettes after a party and you've drunk too many drinks, you for a while think, I should probably stop smoking and I should probably stop drinking just for a bit because I feel really bad. And I think that phones and the perpetual addiction and dopamine hit of phones, finally the hangover is occurring. And people are going back to these devices going, I'd like to use the camera and I'd like to read the news, but I don't think I need to be scrolling for 6 hours a day because I don't feel very well after doing that. Obviously, there's moves afoot to put phones in people's pockets at schools and not bring them out. Very good. I think that as a parent or concerned parent, I see that as an opportunity to change the narrative for children. And I think there are a lot of exciting things happening with regard to ecology and trying to change the narrative around that. I'm over the doomsterism of it because I think instead of feeling oppressed, you know, Timothy Morton, a friend of mine, came up with this concept of hyperobjects. And hyperobjects being these immovable, massive things that weigh you down. They're too big for you to deal with, right? You can't deal with climate change on your own. But the way to avoid depression is to feel like you have some agency. And the thing that I've left my son with, who's now turning 15 in less than a week's time, is that, Arlo, you can't change the world of climate change on your own, but you can be useful and learn skills that make you helpful to people who are dealing with the consequences. And by being useful and having a toolkit of things you can do to make it easier to live through the consequences of something that's much bigger than all of us that we have to collectively deal with, at least you're not going to sit there hiding under a rock worrying about it. You'll have some agency to do something that feels constructive and positive and helpful and be useful. So I suppose my message for the new year is try and be useful and try and help people. And, you know, there's no revolution without evolution, as they say.
Fantastic. Those are New Year's revolutionary resolutions to live by. Thank you so much, Andrew. That's absolutely brilliant. Now, I do have one final question for you, and it's one that we ask all of our VIP guests, everyone from Claire O'Neill to Carl Cox to Suzanne Chani to everybody who's been on the show. And that is to nominate a musical track that you love to add to our infinite VIP title playlist.
I have selected the Yellow Magic Orchestra, Ryoichi Sakamoto's band from the 70s, RIP Ryoichi. And he did an album with them called Technodelic in 1981. And on Technodelic in 1981, it was one of my favorite records, there is a track number 7, Gradated Grey. Gradated Grey, which is the order of the day. And that's my track, Gradated Grey by Yellow Magic Orchestra.
Phenomenal choice. Thank you so much, Andrew. I'm going to be a bit more obvious in my choice. The track is Protection. The band is Massive Attack, but it's the Eno remix because it's just gorgeous. It's like 10 minutes long. It's got all these Storm recordings. And like your good self, Andrew, he's one of these amazing visionaries that overlaps music and culture and technology in a way that kind of enlightens the rest of the world. So, Andrew, thank you so, so much for joining us.
A great pleasure.
Okay, folks, that was the great Andrew Melchior. I really hope you enjoyed the discussion. We talked about about the long arc of music and technology, what it all means, all about creativity in an age of machines, why collective creation and collective meaning still matters, and exactly what's at stake in 2026 and beyond. If this conversation resonated with you, feel free to share it, feel free to recommend it to your friends, and by all means, join us as a subscriber. It's free on your favorite podcast channel. So if you enjoyed this conversation, make sure to follow Audio Talks wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and feel free to leave a review. It does help more people get to know our amazing guests like Andrew Melchior. For more exclusive content, some behind-the-scenes goodies, and maybe even some competitions, feel free to follow the Audio Talks podcast over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. My name is Oisin Lunny. Happy New Year. Whatever you do, let's be useful and let's be part of a better future. And we will see you in the next series.